You're listening to another great podcast in the MyMac Podcasting Network.
TechFan Podcast number 517. I'm Tim Robertson, joined by David Cohen in the UK. Hello, David.
Hello.
I'm in the US, if you can't tell by my accent. I know a lot of people think, is he Australian? Maybe New Zealand? No. No, it's the US. Yeah, so welcome to 2025.
Oh, isn't it exciting?
It's so exciting. It's going to be a great year for everyone.
In fact, I kind of feel like I've had my 7-day trial of 2025, and I'm not going to subscribe this year.
Yeah, I'm wondering. It seems a little... Yeah. Well, let's just skip right to 2030. See where we're at. See how many people are still alive then.
Exactly.
It's been not a great start to the year, obviously. We got quite a few listeners in California, and what's happening in LA right now is just horrific.
Yeah.
These fires and these super strong winds, and Palisades is gone, basically, and man, it's just, it's unbelievable. I could not imagine what they're going through right now.
No, to basically lose your, if you lose your home, it's like losing your entire life.
Because, yeah, but these people lost their entire neighborhood, their whole everything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you lived in Palisades and worked in Palisades, your job's gone, your home's gone, everything you own is gone. You basically have what you took with you.
Yeah.
You know, it's just awful. How do you start? I don't even know how you start over from that. Where do you even start?
Yeah, I know. It's hard to imagine. And obviously, you know, people lose their houses in fires all the time, but it's worse when you lose your community, because then you've got nobody around you, and you don't even know whether your community is going to come back. I mean, a lot of these places might not ever be rebuilt.
I'm sure Palisades will be rebuilt, but you know, every businesses? No. Does everyone who lived there is going to move back and rebuild? No. I mean, it's going to change everything.
Yeah.
And the problem is we keep seeing this over and over and over, and yet, you know, we're not really doing anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, one politician starts blaming another politician, and it's just not—it's not a good situation.
No.
But we're going to try to focus on other stuff today. I don't know if you listened, but I was on the 100th episode of the MyMac podcast with Guy. Did an interview. He's carrying over the interviews with you and Chad Perry and the rest. I think on 101, 102, something like that. So those are coming as well. I was hoping. I was kind of skipping through it to get to the interviews with everybody else, but it looked like it was just me on that one, which I was bummed out because I wanted to hear your interview. I was really looking forward to hearing one from Chad and see what Owen had to say, but, you know, have to wait for this week,
I guess he had too much content to fit in one show.
Yeah, that's okay. You know, as I've said many, many times, there's no rules to podcasting. You kind of do it how you want to do it.
Yeah.
Speaking of how you want to do it, I kind of wanted to look back on this episode. It's 30 years, not quite. It's during 1995 that it was released, but it's been 30 years since Windows 95 came out. And I was a diehard Mac user at the time when Windows came out, and I made fun of it all the time. But the cultural and technological impact of Windows 95 is still being felt to this day. How you market products, how you hype them up. But Windows 95 was something that was totally different than anything Microsoft had done before. It was a technological leap that needed to happen, and the marketing behind it was insane.
Yeah. I think it was the first time we saw that level of computer marketing. I mean, it really penetrated the mainstream. I mean, it was all over the news.
It was everywhere.
People knew that something big in computing was going on. And back in the mid-90s, a lot of people weren't really interested in computers at all. It was much more, even then, was still more of a niche thing. You might use one at work, and even then, you didn't always use one at work. But certainly at home, you might have a home computer, you might not necessarily have a PC. And I think one of the things the consumer push with Windows 95 did is it really kick-started the PC industry in the way that it went from being a business-orientated industry to a much more home-orientated industry, because Windows 95 enabled so much. One of the things it did was, because it It merged Windows and DOS into a single... It wasn't really a single operating system. Windows 95 still ran on top of DOS, but it extended DOS to the point that...
it was almost invisible if you wanted it to be.
Exactly. But the thing is, it standardized so much. It standardized the driver model. It standardized the programming interfaces and the GUIs and all of this sort of stuff. And it made software development for the PC much, much easier. And that meant that that people started developing all sorts of programs for the PC. And the games industry in particular really took off because it was much easier to develop games for a Windows computer than it was for a DOS computer. And to get them running as a user, you could just... If you installed it into Windows and your computer was able to run Windows well, then you were pretty much guaranteed that the game would work.
Yep.
Whereas under DOS, if you wanted to run a game under DOS, you had to edit command lines, you had to edit batch files, you might have to adjust the memory allocation to make sure the game had enough memory. You then had to deal with drivers for joysticks and sound cards, and depending on what you had... there was no guarantee you could get it working. It was a really techie thing to do. And what Windows did is it took all of that away because all of that stuff was standardized. And if your game controller, well, it was a joystick at the time, but if you had a joystick connected, then Windows had a driver built in for it, so it would always work with a game. And if you had a sound card and you could hear sounds in Windows, then you knew you could hear the sounds in your games.
Yep.
Whereas under DOS, that wasn't guaranteed at all. So it really did... This is why Microsoft promoted it so hard, because they knew it would sell PCs, and the more PCs they sold, the more software they would sell. And so
$300 million is what Microsoft spent promoting Windows 95. Now, $300 million today in 1995 dollars is $500 million.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more than a half, but it's $621 million. So over $500 million in just marketing. And yeah. Much as I made fun of Windows back in the day, because, I was a diehard Mac user, and Mac was still better as far as usability, but that's not what the industry was running on. And Microsoft was very smart to not just overhype it, but hype it as much as they did.
Yeah, and let's face it, Windows 95 basically brought the PC much closer in parity to the Mac. Because it brought a very Mac-like system to the Windows PC. And it gave it a lot of the advantages that the Mac had.
The start button, in terms of instance.
The standardization, the ease of use. You could see all your files and programs in one place. You didn't have to go looking for them in the directories. You could have an icon on your desktop. It had a desktop. It had a single place where your computing was centralized, which obviously they completely... took from the Mac GUI, but the point is that is such a good way of computing that all our devices today, even the non-Windows ones and the non-Mac ones like the iPad, the iPhone, they use the same thing, a single screen with icons for all your programs and files on. Yeah, I mean, it's intuitive, and that's why Windows 95 copied it, because the previous version of Windows, Windows 3.1, it had a lot of that stuff, but basically... the DOS stuff underneath was still there. You could see it all. And it meant it wasn't anywhere near as automated and as easy to use. And as somebody who... my first job, I took all our DOS machines that were running things like WordPerfect and Lotus 1-2-3, and I recommended to the company that they move them all to Windows 3.1 because the software was a lot easier to use for all of our non-technical staff. And they really embraced it. But at the same time, we had a couple of Macs in the company that we used for running Photoshop and stuff like that, and for doing computer graphics type work and for making flyers and posters and all of that sort of stuff. And really, the Windows 95 would have brought those older PCs to much closer to being able to do that sort of stuff. But still, technically and hardware-wise, years behind the Mac at that point. But the point is, it looked the same. And the look and feel and the intuitiveness of the interface was a big part of Windows 95's success.
$209.95 is what a boxed edition of Windows 95 cost when it was released in August of 95.
Well, here's the weird thing about that $300 million of marketing spend. They were trying and succeeded in getting people to buy a piece of software that out of the box didn't do an awful lot apart from give you a new operating system.
7 million copies in 5 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, I remember people were queuing outside stores to buy it. They were queuing in the middle of the night. It was like an Apple event, really.
Yeah, I remember the giant boxes that were in so many stores.
Yeah.
And Windows 95 upgrade.
So the place I was working when Windows 95 came along was kind of, we called ourselves the Information Center, and we were basically the second line tech support for the energy company that I was working for at the time. So we had a lot of users. We had about 4,500 users, most of whom were running either DOS or Windows 3.1. And so because we were the second line tech support, we were like the tech advisors. So we had the betas of Windows 95 running for months before it was officially launched.
Right.
And we were trying it out. And of course, back then, you know, Windows 95 really increased the hardware requirements, especially for memory. You couldn't run
there
it.
There was a lot of people who wanted to update to Windows 95 that immediately had to go out and buy a new PC. And that was, of course, a huge boon to the PC industry as a whole because, oh, yeah, that computer you got 2 years ago can't run Windows 95.
Yeah, you needed more memory. You needed
more hard
tended
drive
to need
space.
A larger hard disk space. And basically, it didn't run well on the slower 286, 386 processors.
Nope.
So I don't think it ran at all on a 286. You needed 386 or better.
Yeah, but 386s sucked with Windows 95. They
just exactly. Said. You really needed to be moving up to 486 or Pentium to really get the best out of Windows 95. So it drove a lot of sales.
When did Pentium come out? When was the first year for Pentium?
I think it was after Windows 95. I think Windows 95 kind of stimulated the processor industry as well. I mean, obviously, Intel back then were very much in bed with Microsoft and, you know, kind of knew that more performance was required. So the Pentium came out in 1993.
Yeah, but it wasn't until the Pentium 2 that it really did anything.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was 97.
Yeah.
Yep. Because until Pentium 2, people were still running 486s. That was the big thing. Nobody was going to Pentium 1.
Even less than that. I mean, the 486s were expensive. A lot of people were running 386 and even 386SX.
No, I'm talking about when in 95, when Windows came out, more people were running 486 at that point than had, and that's what people were upgrading to. Because I still remember a lot of the online forums talking about, hey, I've got a 386, and how do I update? And people are all, you need a 486. You need a 486. Nobody was talking Pentium 1s at the time.
Right. Yeah, but that was the thing. I mean, there was a lot of people, because of DOS and Windows 3.1, a lot of people with 386 computers who said, well, I want to run Windows 95. And it was like, well, you need a whole new computer.
Exactly.
Which was a lot of money back then. Windows 95 really was a big investment, but people were prepared to do it because the advantages it gave you. It was a whole new computing environment. Not that Windows 95 was perfect by any stretch of the imagination.
No, it had its problems.
You go and run it today, and it's amazing. I mean, I remember like things like USB support didn't come until Windows 98, and it was a later version of Windows 98 as well.
Thing until Windows 98 really corrected a lot of the. If anything, Windows 98 was more of an upgrade for Windows 95 than its own standalone starting from scratch. I mean,
absolutely.
And, Windows 95, a lot of people don't realize it was built on Windows NT. It wasn't a built from scratch OS.
In fact, I remember when you installed it, it was still running on top of DOS. You had to install DOS first before you could install Windows 95. And I remember those early versions of Windows 95 came on a big stack of floppy disks.
Yeah.
I mean, that was how you installed it. There was about 20 or so floppy disks. You had to put in one after the other to get it up and running.
You could get a CD, but...
Well, yeah, but when 95 came out, CD-ROMs weren't a thing. They were a thing.
But
I had
almost
one for my DOS computer, but they weren't really a mainstream thing, and the things people ran on them were kind of like Expedia and... not Expedia, but... Something like that, you know, these multimedia things. Exactly. People didn't really use them as a software distribution mechanism. And it was only when, the stacks of floppy started arriving, then people started going, well, you know, CD would be better than that. But again, Windows 95 gave you a standardized CD-ROM interface. If there was a CD-ROM drive in your computer and you ran Windows 95, you could easily access it. Whereas with DOS, again, you had to install a driver, you had to configure it, you had to give it a drive letter yourself, you had to do a whole load of manual techie stuff to get a CD-ROM working on a DOS machine. So a lot of people wouldn't do that because it was a lot of effort just to be able to install software. Whereas with Windows, well, if it was in there, it worked. And if it worked, that meant that you could install software from it. So the whole thing was kind of a virtuous cycle, really.
Well, yes. It's also started, you had to have, well, it was going to run a 32-bit architecture, which was a big, and it had protected memory, kind of.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, the biggest problem with Mac users at the time is if one app crashed, your entire computer's crashed. Windows 95. And
it was the same. It was the same with Windows 3.1.
Exactly.
It had the same memory model. Well, DOS didn't multitask at all.
Correct.
But Windows 3.1 did, but it was the same thing as the Mac. It was cooperative, which means if one file, with one program went down, it brought the entire system down. Whereas with Windows 95, everything was notionally protected from everything else.
And I believe it could still run Windows 16-bit, but it did that in its... Was it virtualized? I can't remember.
It wasn't even as sophisticated as virtualized. Basically, it did some kind of mode switch when you went to a 16-bit program. It was pretty clunky.
Yes.
But
it
gave you a level of backward compatibility. But the important thing was that it enabled much better programs to develop. It had more access to more memory. They were much more graphical.
And you said earlier, which can't go understated, it allowed companies, software developers, to start developing without having to worry about the underlying anything. You already knew that it would have support for sound cards and floppies, and it was going to do that.
And not only that, if you wanted, obviously, you wanted to build a GUI interface, you did not have to build your own GUI interface,
correct,
which is what you had to do under DOS. So you could use the system interface, which gave programs kind of common look and feel. And also it took a whole load of development time away because you could concentrate on the program functionality rather than the way you interface the user.
You
didn't have to write mouse drivers, you didn't have to write a pointer, of this stuff.
Windows 95 started the whole device manager thing.
Yeah.
Which was, the program that would allow the system to just automatically detect. Or if you needed to, you can go in there and switch to different devices. It was very clever for its time.
Yeah,
and in a lot of respects, though, it's still there, even under the current Windows.
You look at Windows 10 today and compare it to the Windows 95 home screen, and you can see it's different, but you can see it's architecturally, it looks the same.
Yes.
It's broadly the same concepts, and that's something that's been going for 30 years, and you certainly can't say that about the Mac. If you look at the old versions of Mac OS before they went to Mac OS X, it actually completely changed functionally because it was a completely new architecture. Whereas actually you can go all the way back, and it's less possible now, but certainly for a long time, you could go to the latest version of Windows, even XP and stuff like that, and still run Windows 95 programs directly in XP. It supported it.
Windows
it doesn't
95
anymore.
My browser.
Yeah, now it runs in a browser. You could run it on the smallest device going. You'd probably get it going on an Apple Watch if you wanted. not that that would be a great experience.
I just booted one up, and it's literally... it thinks it's running on a Compact Desk Pro 386 with 4 megabytes of RAM. Yep. And it's starting, and there it is. It's booting up. It's so crazy. Here's the specs, by the way. The official requirements were an Intel 386 DX CPU, 4 megabytes of system RAM, and 50 to 55 megabytes of hard disk space, or one song on your iPhone. But it's true, though. That's what it took. It's still booting, by the way.
There's a lot of people. They're a niche, but there are a lot of people who like running old software on modern computers because it is blindingly fast because the system requirements are so low. And actually, I think famously George Martin, who writes Game of Thrones, he writes everything in WordStar on DOS because he knows all the keyboard shortcuts and everything happens instantly on his computer.
So mine says, welcome to Windows 95. Did you know? Did you remember the little did you know things that used to pop up? Yeah. But you could turn off show of this on your next boot. If you don't know how to do something, you can look it up in the help. Just click start button and click help. How helpful is that? So let's do that. So we're going to go to start and help. And what's the first thing it shows? Nothing. It's taken forever to launch. If you've used Windows before is the first one. Introduction to Windows, how to, tips and tricks and troubleshooting. Very clever. That's the way to do it. You make it simple and easy to get to.
Well, again, it was, it was to make everything, you know, there was one answer to how to do things. I mean, there wasn't really, but actually they made it look like there was one way of doing everything. Of course, Microsoft being Microsoft, they never got rid of any of those ways when they added something new. So now there's about 15 different ways to do anything in Windows. But back then, you know, there was one way where rather than, again, with these DOS programs, you had to figure out how the developer had implemented something. Even as simple as finding out if there was help, which there normally wasn't because there was no internet back then. So if it wasn't built into the program, there was nothing. Normally the help was open the paper manual and try and use the index.
Yes.
But
good luck with that.
And that's one of the reasons why the boxes were so big, because they all came with big books, which were manuals on how to use the software you just bought. And remember as well how expensive software was back then?
It was prohibitively
Windows
expensive.
Was over $200. I know if you wanted to buy a copy of DBase or WordPerfect, you were looking at $400-$500 per copy. And, you know, God help you if you needed a whole office full of, you know, 25, 30 machines running all that stuff. It was big. It was big money.
It's amazing how far we've come, but it's also kind of funny in how our muscle memory comes back when you start using something like Windows 95 that we haven't used realistically in 28 years, right? And yet, I know how to do all this stuff. I remember so much of this.
Yeah, and not only that, a lot of the ways you do things in Windows 95 is still the way you do things today. If you want to run a program, you double-click its icon on the desktop and it will load. You want to look for a file, you go to a file explorer and you can see a window of your hard drive just in the same way you can today. So, as this one's saying, most of the Windows concepts, and they're concepts that many other computing devices use, were all baked in back then and still used today.
13, by the way, that's the number of floppy disks the installation was on. So, yeah. Do you remember how long it took to put one in and clank, 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 sits there and reads the whole thing and then eventually spits it out?
I didn't think it spit it out.
I think it just said install the next one.
On a PC, it didn't spit it out because they didn't have motorized drives. You had to do it yourself. I remember you. For many computers where I worked, so I had to install Windows onto a new computer, get that up and running configured, and then I had to install Microsoft Office. Microsoft Office was 45 or more floppies.
So one update for you was half a day.
Oh yeah, yeah. We and there was no imaging. There was networking, but there was no network imaging back then. So everything had to be done by hand on each computer.
Yeah, you had to set up every network, every printer, install the software, have a spreadsheet with all the different product keys on it. Oh, my God.
Yep. I remember it
because I was an IT manager from 99 through 2004. It Mac-based, but I was also running a Windows NT server. So I was playing with that all the time as well. I think... collectively we forget how crappy it was. Nostalgia and oh my God, it was great and things were so much simpler back then. No, they weren't. It pretty much sucked.
the amount of I mean, one of the things where Windows did fall down, still falls down a little bit today to be honest, is things like printer drivers. You often had printing problems, things wouldn't print. I'm thinking back to my information center days when I would run the help desk and we had a spreadsheet with all the open calls in.
Yeah.
A lot of them were printers. A lot of them were, I need a driver for this and I can't figure out how to install it myself. And we had to go and find the driver and then drive over to the guy's computer and install it for him so he could use whatever it was.
Here's the thing. You the first thing you always told everyone, at least it was the first thing that I told everyone. Do you remember what that was?
Turn it off and on again.
Yes.
Yeah. Reboot it.
That cured, I'm going to say 90% of the problems.
Yeah.
You know, ones that, hey, I can't print to the large format printer. Okay. Did you reboot yet? No. Okay. Reboot and call me back if it's not working. And they would never call back.
Yeah. I mean, but here's the thing as well. Windows 95 was the beginning of online Windows updates.
Yes.
That was when they introduced that system, which again was completely radical because they were starting to try and move people away from some guy has to come out and do it for you.
Windows 95 is the reason that Apple bought Next. That's the reason, because the Mac OS did not have protective memory. And by the time Windows 98 rolled around, they were in big trouble with their next generation OS. They had been trying for years to build it in-house, and they just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And it was a success of Windows 95 and leaving the Mac in the dust for a few technological reasons, not usability, but, you know, usability is not everything. That's why they bought Next Computers. They had to have something.
And not only that, that famous scene in all the Mac Apple documentaries where Microsoft invests in Apple to keep it going. Part of that deal, the biggest part of that deal wasn't the money. It was Microsoft committing to bringing a browser and also Microsoft Office, keeping it on the Mac.
Yes.
Because they knew if they lost Office, the Mac was done because nobody would buy it because they were buying computers to use Office products and typically Microsoft Office. And so they knew they had to have it. And that was the
1997. That was the real, and it was only $150 million investment, half of what they spent in just marketing Windows.
The money was immaterial.
No, it wasn't the money. No.
It was the commitment to the software support.
Yep.
And that was back in the day when Microsoft was so dominant that Apple needed Microsoft to support them to keep it going. You know, a decade later, they completely turned it around, and it was different.
It was the money, though, for Apple.
Yeah.
Because they were so close to bankruptcy, that $150 million really saved them a lot.
Well, it allowed them to push the next projects, basically the iMac.
Yep.
And I don't know whether the iPod came from there, but it kept them going enough to be able to launch the iMac and then the iPod. Obviously, when the iPod came along, all of a sudden they had an alternative revenue stream and things got a lot better. And then they, as we know, interestingly enough, 1998 was that investment. And by
97.
Yeah, but by in less than 10 years, by 2003, 2004, I mean, Apple was well on the up again because Jobs was back and the iPod was there and all the Macs suddenly got better. Obviously, OS X was out and all of a sudden Apple was on that upward trajectory that you would argue they've never left since.
No,
but that was only 6 years after that. You know, that investment when they're on the ropes, it really was a big turnaround. But again, without Windows 95, Next would have never been created. And so, you know, computing could have been very different if Microsoft hadn't decided to go down that track. And I think what we also remember is that we should remember is that IBM were also working with Microsoft at the time, and they had a different operating system, OS 2, which was much more advanced. It was basically like Windows NT before Windows NT came along. And from a technical point of view, that probably should have won, but it didn't. And Windows 95 was Microsoft's basically Skunk Works project to kind of bootstrap themselves towards that sort of operating system without recreating everything from scratch.
Do you think OS 2 lost simply from a marketing and home user perspective? Because that's what I always assumed.
I think it lost because Bill Gates wanted to do something they developed rather than have something that IBM had developed.
Yeah.
And I think the reason they put $300 million between Windows 95 was basically to make sure that OS 2 didn't succeed and that Microsoft's own software did. And they took a much longer path. I mean, they had about a year after Windows 95, they had Windows NT 4.
Yes.
And now I remember installing for customers Windows NT 3.51, which was a fully, you know, it was basically the system that became Windows XP. It was much, much better than Windows 95. It was complete operating system, much more advanced, secure,
there was no DOS
faster.
Underneath it.
No, exactly. But the thing is, the interface on it looked like Windows 3. And then they did Windows NT 4, which looked like Windows 95.
Yep.
And they had to do that because Windows 95 had been so successful, people wanted to use the same interface. But the underlying architecture was much different. And it wasn't until Windows 2000 that effectively Microsoft started to move away from the 95 product code and start saying, we don't want DOS underneath, we want it all one single operating system. That didn't really properly happen until the success of Windows XP. You know, when Windows XP came out, a lot of people were still running DOS and Windows 9X, as it was known by then, 98 or Windows ME. And it was only really the success of XP that got rid of that.
Windows, the first update to Windows 95 OEM release date number one, included, by default, installed it, Internet Explorer version 2.
Yeah.
Because version 1 was available, but only as a higher-end upgrade to Windows 95. So,
well, yeah,
you had Microsoft.
Microsoft came to the internet very late. They were really caught flat-footed by it, and famously, Bill Gates had to write a letter to the whole company saying, "We are now committed to the internet."
Yep.
When he realized that it was more than just a fad, and obviously, what happened then with Internet Explorer was that to recover, they then started becoming very anti-competitive and very nearly got split up over that, because Internet Explorer was at the heart of the Microsoft antitrust trial.
Yeah. When looking back at Windows 95, you know, it kind of was the beginning of the current, what we have today. It really was.
Yeah.
It was a seminal moment in computing history. And, you know, at the time I hated it because I was a Mac guy. And I was, you know, it was 94 when I launched my Mac. So,
yeah,
you know, I saw the rise of Windows 95 and the fall of the Mac OS. But looking back, we wouldn't be where we are today without Windows 95. We just wouldn't.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And it's surprising that Bill Gates almost missed out on the internet when you really think about it. You think with someone as smart as him, that it seemed obvious, but.
Well, you know, it's well, I think they call it the success dilemma.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got something that does very well, it's very difficult to say, right, well, we're going to change what we do to something completely different that might be, that's a gamble. And the innovator's dilemma, it's called. And so that was his problem, is that basically he was so focused on what was successful in Microsoft that he couldn't see the opportunity of the internet. Until he did. And, you know, the only thing I'd hand to Bill Gates is that he was very good at ruthlessly driving at something when he realized it was what they had to do.
Steve Jobs was the same. They had that in common. I think that Steve Jobs just had better taste when it came to technology.
Definitely.
But they had the same mindset. You know, if this is where the industry's going, we're not going to be the first there. Microsoft almost is never the first there either. A lot of people say, oh, Apple, they didn't invent MP3 players or smartphones. But they did it better than most people.
Yeah.
And they knew how to market it. And it just worked. And that was the difference. Let's talk about something else here. CES, I believe, just ended.
It did.
And I don't want to say it was a yawn fest. There was some neat things that I saw, but... Again, we're in an age of everything's AI. It's incremental updates. It's nothing brand new.
A lot of bizarre stuff. People throwing stuff at the wall.
Well,
I mean,
Nvidia
more so than usual.
Nvidia came out with a new graphic card and a mini supercomputer. They call it a mini supercomputer. It's all very interesting, but none of it really made me look. I'm not a hardcore PC gamer. So I'm not going to rush out, but these new video cards are half the price of the old ones and they have better performance.
Well, that has been one of Nvidia's challenges over the last few years, is that they've been doing really great hardware, but they've been very, very expensive. And I think they really want to, you know, they've got this huge market capitalization on the back of AI. And I think they've worked very hard on cost optimization because they realize that, you know, they're killing the golden goose by making their hardware too expensive. And they recognize PC gaming is on the up. And also, they've got a big competitor because AMD is producing these integrated chipsets that are going in these gaming handhelds that are much more competitive than NVIDIA stuff.
Yeah.
And there is a risk, if NVIDIA's not more careful, that they'll become a niche only for AI processing and special computing. But for general graphics and games, people will rely on the integrated stuff because it's all getting so good.
Yep.
So I think this is their pushback against that. The challenge I think NVIDIA has in the PC gaming space is that so many of these products now are built into the devices. They're not separate gaming cards. And so having not that many non-hardcore gamers have a separate desktop PC that can even take a graphics card. They want to play games on their laptops, and NVIDIA has to convince manufacturers to put their separate discrete GPUs into laptops, which drives up the price.
I'm going to disagree with you there. I think a few years ago, yes, laptops were really starting to come on when it came to hardcore PC gaming, but it's flipped back the other way. I know quite a few hardcore PC gamers, and they're not gaming on laptops. They've gone back to desktops because the difference of pure hardware power between a laptop and a desktop has grown massively over the last couple of years. I mean, it's nobody is, if you're a serious PC gamer, you are not gaming on a laptop. You are gaming on a full-blown PC, a desktop PC.
I don't disagree with you. I think the challenge is that if you got games that you want to sell millions and millions of copies, you can sell many more millions of copies if those games will run on non-discrete hardware. I think there's a lot of gamers who
quite like. You got to go with the lowest common denominator, sure.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of more casual gamers who like games but don't want to spend £1,000 or $1,000 on a discrete, dedicated desktop PC.
Oh, I agree.
Who would say, you know what, I'd really love it if this laptop that I buy for $600-$700 that I do most of my home stuff on could also play games. And when that happens, then all of a sudden people are going, well, you know, when they become good enough, then dedicated desktop discrete GPUs become even more of a niche, and you can't make big money on a niche.
I think the biggest news in video games didn't come from Microsoft, didn't come from Sony, and it didn't come, well, Nintendo didn't show up at all. Honestly, it came from Steam, and that was the announcement of them releasing a Steam OS that you can install on anything. That was what they said. You could be able to install this on anything.
And we've already had some of the people who do Windows gaming handhelds saying, yeah, we're going to release a Steam version of the next generation. And it's an advantage for them. They don't need to pay the cost of Windows.
Exactly.
And as somebody who has both a Steam Deck, and we've talked about this before, and a ROG Ally, the ROG Ally is a much better gaming device than the Steam Deck, but it's nowhere near as simple.
Yeah, now imagine installing Steam OS on it, and just it boots right up into Steam. That's the power of the Steam Deck. That's why I like the Steam.
Absolutely.
It just works.
Yeah, it just works. And that's the real advantage, especially when you're coming to look at, this market I'm talking about, the big market, which is the non-hardcore gamers.
Yeah,
the more casual gamer. But, you know, people say casual gamers like these are people only play Candy Crush and Fortnite and stuff like that. But, you know, a casual gamer is somebody who wants to play the games they can run.
Yes.
You know, they would all run Call of Duty and Elden Ring and all of these big games if their hardware would allow them to do it, but they just don't want to go out and build a separate device for that. So if you can give them hardware that can do it in their hand, then, and it's a few hundred dollars, then they go, yeah, that works for me.
What signals to me, what this signals for Steam or Valve owns Steam, right?
Yeah.
So, is they realize that being in the hardware market is not where they want to be long term. They would rather be Microsoft and Windows 95, that their software and their store runs on everything. So it doesn't matter if you buy a Dell handheld, you buy a laptop, or it will just run SteamOS. And is the smart play. That is where the money is. That's what Microsoft figured out a long time ago. They didn't care about building the PC. That's not where the money was. The underlying technology, OS, that's where the money's at, the operating system.
And, you know, Valve recognizes this very well. The Steam platform is their big cash cow.
Yes.
It's what makes their company huge amounts of money. And they've done the Steam Deck on the back of that success because they do realize that actually if they can not have a separate OS on the device, but they can own the whole widget from the software stack upwards, then people can't go anywhere else to buy games. If you've got a Steam Deck, it's very difficult if you want to go to the Epic Game Store. It can be done, but you need to do all sorts of installs and hacking around in the Linux underlying things to get those games working. Whereas with Steam, you know, they're guaranteed to work, provided that Valve says that they work on the platform they've given you.
And that's the other issue, is that they need to do a much better job of making these games compatible with the Steam OS.
But it's I think that's the cleverness of the Steam Deck, is they've done so much work to actually allow these Windows games to run under Linux on Steam OS that, you know, they are really investing heavily in that. But what they're doing is they're creating, the Steam Deck is basically a showing to the market the art of the possible. I think before the Steam Deck came along, if you'd have said, oh, we're going to build a dedicated Linux gaming handheld that only runs Steam and will run, natively run the Windows games, and they'll work great, people would have disbelieved you.
Yes.
They've proved it can be done, so now people are going, well, we can build those handhelds. We don't have to pay for a Windows license. And it's all gravy for Valve, because that means it keeps people more in the Steam ecosystem rather than going to Epic Games or EA Games
exactly
or somewhere
else.
That's
exactly what I said. The money is in the software, not the hardware.
Yeah.
And look, if you could control both, if you do hardware and software, you can make a lot of money. Exhibit A, iPhone, okay? But
yeah,
I think if you want to be the next Microsoft, you've got to be on the software side. You got to provide the store. You want a part of those transactions. You want to be running on every platform. You don't care what people are using. Mac, Windows, Linux, handheld, laptop, doesn't matter. You can run our OS.
Yeah. Here's the thing. As somebody who's a big Steam user, and then I do have quite a lot of games in some of these other games, game platforms like Good Old Games and Epic Games and stuff like that. If I look across my library of all the stuff I've got, there are several places where I have the same game several times.
Yeah, me too.
And the reason for that is that they're not all integrated into one place. So sometimes you buy it again, you don't remember you have it somewhere else. But secondly is, for me, I prefer to have it on Steam than anywhere else because it's so much simpler to use. You know, it's one place. It's my biggest library. And if I have it in Steam, then it's just a button click to play the game.
Exactly.
To install and play the game. And I also wonder how long it will be before Steam starts looking at all that game streaming and going, you know what? If we had that in our platform too, so you didn't even need to install the game.
That's where the bounty is, right there.
You just said it. Yeah.
But here's the problem. They need to do a better job of, if I'm in Steam, all the games just work, and they don't right now.
No.
You know, if I'm on my Mac, I have a library, a pretty large library of Steam games that I cannot play on my Mac.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work. Why not? Why
isn't... on a Mac.
Because I'm on a Mac. Because it's still dependent on the OS, and that's where the problem is.
Yeah, because these games are still developed for Windows.
Exactly.
That's why.
But Steam needs to do a better job that it doesn't matter what platform you're on. They're just going to work.
But it is. I think it's two sides of the same coin. As the Steam Deck type devices and the Steam OS becomes more popular, then it will make more sense for game developers to target that rather than a Windows. And when they target and optimize for that rather than Windows, then that solves Valve's problem because they have less work to do to make the games work properly on Steam OS.
Do you think that Steam eventually takes Steam OS, because it doesn't say anything about games, but it's more than just games? You can browse the web with it. You can get your email real quick.
Maybe. I think as long as there's opportunities for revenue that way, that's fine. I think Valve are very, very focused on the things that on their strategy. If they see that strategy needing to broaden in the future, that's fine. But I think at the moment, they're very much in, you know, we need to make Steam the only place people go for computer gaming. And that's what they're working on. I think anything else would come much later. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure. The problem is that if you're... those other applications, the word processors, the email clients, all of that sort of stuff, those work in companies. And I think many companies would be kind of shy of saying, well, we want you to access a gaming platform to be able to run your business software. So they might have to do it separately. But we'll see. I mean, who knows? What I do understand is, you know, with there's a famous joke in IT circles that every year is the year of the Linux desktop. And it's, you know, by that people mean, oh, you know, people stop buying Windows and they start running Linux desktops. The reality is that SteamOS is the new Linux desktop.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's dedicated not on general computing, it's dedicated to gaming, because let's be honest, gaming is where big money is. But ultimately, if we ever get the year of the Linux desktop, it will be the time when a lot of people are running SteamOS.
They already have released, but it's not the full. You can already download the SteamOS and install it on things.
Yeah.
But it's kind of kludgy right now. They're coming out with a less kludgy automated installation very, very soon, like within the next month or two. But it's out there right now.
Yeah. And they've been talking about doing this. They've been talking about doing two things since the Steam Deck launched. Jerry Yang, who's the chief hardware engineer of the Steam Deck, said right at the beginning, they said, we will give you a way to run Windows on the Steam Deck if you want to. And then the other thing was, they said, and we'll have a independent SteamOS install that you can install on other devices. So it's taking them a few years to get that, because, and let's not underestimate, what they've pulled off with the Steam Deck is really huge. You know, nobody really believed they could build a dedicated hardware device that would be rock solid and successful, and they've done that, and then they've extended it a little bit with the OLED version. And now, you know, this is stage two, where all of a sudden other manufacturers are going to be installing SteamOS onto dedicated devices. And it will turn into an ecosystem. That's what it's starting to do. Huge achievement for Valve. And you know what? What's great about it is it's a real benefit to anybody who likes playing games.
Yep. It's, I think it's very interesting. I think SteamOS is going to be the big news for games in 2025. I think this is going to be the thing that changes a lot. And if they do it right, they can own the gaming market. They could step in between the consumer and Microsoft and Sony. They're not going to step in between the consumer and Nintendo players, because that's a totally...
That's its own ecosystem, and you know, it's rock solid on its own.
Yeah, and they nobody that's a big Nintendo fan cares about SteamOS on their handheld, because they're using it.
When you say that, I think actually there's an awful lot of gamers like you and me.
They do both, but I don't care about the Steam stuff on my Nintendo handheld.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying is that Nintendo is its own ecosystem, and in some respects, it exists outside of the PC gaming space or the console gaming space. Yep. It's its own thing, and it's cheap enough that many people will do both. And many families will do both, because the kids want the Nintendos. Yeah, it's only when they get older that they start wanting the, you know, the PC gaming stuff. But actually, they're quite happy with the Nintendo, and the games they get on there are games they love to play.
I read this article, and this is kind of the gaming segment right here, so let's talk about this real quick. I read this article that the biggest problem with Microsoft and the Xbox and the way that they kind of screwed themselves was the Xbox Series S. That they insisted that any game that runs on Xbox, the new one, the big powerful one, also had to run on the S. And the problem with that is, oh, wait a minute, I don't want to have to code this AAA game to a lower platform like the S. And that's one of the reasons that Microsoft has had so many problems with the Xbox, and why they have such a not a great reputation right now. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Do you think the Series S, that's the discless, the $399, $299. Do you think that held them back, or do you think it was?
Oh, no, I don't. Because Sony is doing this strategy now. They've got a PS5 Pro. It's very expensive, and is a better device than the PS5. And obviously, I'm sure they're saying to their developers, "Well, you've got to produce the game so it runs on the PS5." But we'd also like better graphics on the better performance, better whatever on the PS5 Pro.
Yeah.
So they basically created exactly that same strategy. They think they can pull it off. So I don't think the strategy itself is flawed. I think the problem is that the game industry has become so obsessed with, when we talked about this before, the realistic graphics, the high frame rates, right, and everything like that. And at the same time, they're producing games that look beautiful but are crap.
Yep.
And are costing hundreds of millions of dollars to produce.
Yep.
I think the problem is, if they stop chasing the photorealism and the high frame rates and the hundreds of gigabytes of assets and stuff like that, and concentrate on the core gameplay, everyone will be better and nobody would give a damn what they were running it on.
Yeah.
And Nintendo proves that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, they do.
And so I think it's a fault, not just, it's not necessarily a fault of Xbox's strategy, it's a fault of the game development community generally, in terms of they're chasing what I think are the wrong things. And we're already at a point where these games are, I mean, how much more photorealistic do they have to get?
Yeah.
I don't really want to play a game that looks so realistic that it terrifies me. You know, I kind of like it when it looks like a game.
Cartoons are still a thing, but you know what I mean? Cartoons are so popular, and they don't look anything like the real world.
Exactly. And not only that, there's nothing that irritates me more when I'm even on a lower end device, if I'm playing a game and all of a sudden it stalls or it janks or there's corruption or something like that, and you just think, for God's sake, would you stop chasing all these specular highlights and reflections and, you know, 100 million fine hairs on the guy's head, and just give me a game that works? Because I don't give a damn about anything like that when I'm running through a battlefield trying to shoot guys. I can't see any of that anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's to me is part of the problem here. I like the Xbox S. I had one. Until I switched to my Steam Deck, I had one. I thought it was a great system, and I never looked at that and thought these games look like ass.
No,
you know, they look great. Good.
Yep.
The thing is, it was targeting 1080p and a lower frame rate than the bigger Xbox, and to me that was perfectly fine. I think this is the thing. All of a sudden, the industries think that giving gamers or giving anybody a choice about how much they pay and how much performance they want is a bad thing. And to me, it's just like it's not very consumer friendly at all.
So with that, we're going to wrap up this episode. We did have some feedback from Brandon, but we kind of ran out of time here. We'll get to it though. We'd love to get feedback from everybody. It's theshow@techfanpodcast.com. Of course, you can find us at techfanpodcast.com or the flagship, mymac.com. David, I will see you next week for the Geeks Pub.
See you then.